Nemoto presents pioneers of psychology and psychiatry. Viktor Frankl, Meaning in the Midst of Suffering. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Ava voice. Running time, approximately 33 minutes. Vienna, late autumn 1945. In a city still smelling faintly of smoke and rubble, a thin man in a dark suit stands at the front of a small lecture hall. The windows behind him are patched with cardboard. Outside, tramlines rattle past buildings with their insides exposed. Inside the room, students and war-weary adults sit shoulder to shoulder on mismatched chairs, coats still on, breath faint in the cold air. They have come to hear a psychiatrist who has just returned from the camps. His name is Viktor Emil Frankl. His cheeks are hollow, his hair close-cropped, his eyes too old for his 40 years, but there is a steadiness in the way he grips the lectern, a stubborn vitality that contradicts the devastation etched into his face. He clears his throat, glances at the notes he has scrawled on yellowing paper, and begins to speak about something almost scandalous in the ruins of Europe, the possibility that life, even life marked by horror, can still be meaningful. At first, the room is restless. People cough, shift, whisper. They know what he has endured in outline. The trains, the barbed wire, the crematoria, and some resent the idea that anything good could be salvaged from that abyss. But as Frankl talks, his voice low and accented, the room quiets. He does not offer easy consolation. He does not say that suffering ennobles everyone, nor does he minimize what was lost. Instead, he describes, with a kind of clinical precision that never becomes cold, the way some prisoners collapsed inward while others, somehow, remained inwardly free. He speaks of a man who shared his last crust of bread, a fellow inmate who comforted the dying, a worker who held on because he believed his wife might still be alive. He tells his listeners something radical, that even when we are deprived of every familiar freedom, there still remains one last freedom, how we respond, inwardly, to what happens to us. The words fall into the silence, like stones into deep water. In that cramped hall in shattered Vienna, Frankl is doing something paradoxical. He is not glorifying suffering. He is insisting that human beings are more than what happens to them. To understand how such a claim could come from a man who has watched so much destruction, one has to return to a very different Vienna. The year is 1913. In a middle-class Jewish apartment in the city's second district, a little boy sits at the kitchen table, drawing with intense concentration. Outside, street vendors cry their wares. The city hums with the confidence of a fading empire. Inside, Viktor, 8 years old, is trying to work out what it means to exist at all. His parents, Gabriel and Elsa, are ordinary Viennese Jews, respectable, hardworking, committed to education. His father is a civil servant, strict but principled. His mother, gentle, holds the family together in a household where respectability matters. At school, Viktor is bright, talkative, fascinated by questions that make other children roll their eyes. He peppers his teachers with queries about life, death, and destiny. One day, in a biology class on the origins of life, the young boy argues with his teacher. If life is only chemistry, he wants to know, where do love and responsibility fit? It is not an act of rebellion. It is the early stirrings of a lifelong obsession. The child is already wrestling with questions that will later fill entire books. As a teenager in the turbulent years following the First World War, Frankl finds his way into the orbit of Vienna's booming psychological scene. The city is alive with new ideas. Cafes buzz with arguments about Freud, Marx, and the aftershocks of war. At school, Frankl writes an essay on the meaning of life that so impresses his teacher it finds its way to Sigmund Freud himself. Freud publishes the piece in a journal, a small gesture that thrills the young author but does not turn him into a disciple. Frankl is fascinated by psychoanalysis, yet even in those early years, he is uneasy with explanations that reduce the human being to a tangle of drives. He attends lectures by Alfred Adler, who emphasizes feelings of inferiority and the striving for power. For a while, the young student joins Adler's circle, but he parts ways when he senses that any one formula that claims to explain everything leaves something out, some irreducible spark in human beings that reaches beyond pleasure or superiority. While other young minds are choosing camps, Freudian, Adlerian, Marxist, Frankl holds onto a stubborn intuition that people are driven above all by a hunger for meaning. He enrolls in medical school at the University of Vienna, specializing in neurology and psychiatry. The hospital wards where he trains are crowded with patients whose lives have been shattered by war, inflation, and political unrest. There are young veterans with tremors and nightmares, factory workers ground down by poverty, housewives paralyzed by despair. Many of them speak not so much of symptoms as of pointlessness. What is the use, they ask? Why go on? While colleagues focus on diagnosing and cataloging mental illnesses, Frankl finds himself listening for something else, the story each patient tells themselves about their life. When a young woman talks of insomnia and headaches, he notices her words about loneliness and purposelessness. When a man complains of anxiety, Frankl hears a buried sense of having betrayed his own values. The future logotherapist is already listening beneath the symptom for the question of meaning. In the early 1930s, unemployment and political tension are rising. Suicide among adolescents is a real and growing threat. Frankl, still in his 20s, organizes a special counseling program for students in Vienna and later in other Austrian cities. He volunteers late into the evening, meeting youths who feel that their lives are over before they have begun. Some are failing exams and feel they have disgraced their families. Others feel crushed by expectations or see no prospects in a collapsing economy. Instead of treating them as weak, Frankl takes them seriously. He asks about their talents, their hopes, the people who matter to them. He helps them imagine futures in which they might be needed, in which their existence could make a difference. Through this work, he begins to see a pattern. Suicide, he realizes, often follows when a person's sense that life has meaning collapses. The symptom is despair. The deeper wound is a loss of meaning. Without calling it so yet, he is already practicing what will later be known as logotherapy, a therapy that helps people discover not what they want from life, but what life is asking of them. The political horizon darkens. The swastika begins to appear not as a distant threat, but as a concrete power. Austria is annexed in 1938. Anti-Jewish laws tighten like a noose. Jewish doctors are pushed out of hospitals. Jewish citizens herded into smaller and smaller corners of public life. Frankl, whose reputation as a clinician is growing, receives an immigration visa to the United States. It is a golden escape ticket, a chance to begin again far from the gathering storm. He and his fiancée, Tilly, discuss the possibility in whispered conversations late at night. In his diary, Frankl wrestles with the moral arithmetic. He could save himself and perhaps his future family. But his parents, aging and vulnerable, have no such option. One evening, he returns home to find his father sitting at the table, turning over in his hands a piece of broken marble inscribed with a fragment of a commandment from a synagogue the Nazis have destroyed. The words, "Honor thy father and thy mother," seem to Frankl like a private message. He makes his choice. He tears up his visa. He will stay in Vienna with his parents, with his people, whatever comes. What comes is everything he feared and more. In 1942, Frankl, his wife, his parents, and his brother board a train with hundreds of other Jews. Their luggage has been carefully packed according to instructions, no jewelry, only essentials, and among Frankl's treasures is the manuscript of a book, the synthesis of years of work on the human search for meaning. He has poured himself into those pages, believing that, even in madness, the world might still listen to the kind of psychiatry that takes the human soul seriously. The train journey is long, crowded, and thick with dread. When the doors finally open at their Seinstadt, a garrison town turned into a ghetto camp, the new arrivals are bewildered by the filth and the shouting guards. The manuscript is confiscated along with other belongings. For a moment, Frankl feels not just dispossessed, but erased, his life's work reduced to a bundle of paper tossed into oblivion. Their Seienstadt is a place of disease, hunger, and illusions. The Nazis maintain a facade of cultural life, a cabaret here, an orchestra there, to deceive Red Cross inspectors, but behind the staged performances, people starve and die. Frankl is assigned work as a physician treating typhus, malnutrition, and despair. He watches elders crumble, children wither, young men rage, and then give up. Yet even in this grotesque parody of a town, he continues to ask his patients not only about their symptoms, but about their reasons for living. One man tells him he wants to see his daughter again. Another believes he must survive to complete a scientific project. A woman clings to the hope of reuniting with her husband. Frankl notices that those who can connect their lives to some task, some person, some responsibility that lies beyond the barbed wire, often bear their suffering differently. He begins to think of meaning as a kind of inner orientation, something that can give a person a reason to endure even when everything outwardly has been stripped away. In 1944, the transports begin to move again. Frankl, his family, and thousands of others are packed into cattle cars headed east. The journey ends at Auschwitz. The name, even later, will carry a weight almost impossible to bear, but for the prisoners stepping down from the train, it is not a symbol. It is a smell, a shouted order, a line of faces illuminated by searchlights. On the ramp, men and women are sorted in a few seconds by the flick of an officer's hand, left or right, life or immediate death. Frankl is sent one way, his mother and father another. He does not see them again. The manuscript he once carried is long gone. Even his name is replaced by a number tattooed on his arm. Yet in the middle of this mechanized attempt to reduce humans to anonymous units, something in him refuses to yield to that logic. Later he will recall repeating to himself a line from Nietzsche about those who have a why to live being able to bear almost anyhow. The words are not a magic spell, but they help him hold onto a conviction that will shape everything he teaches after the war, that it is not suffering itself that destroys a person, but suffering that seems meaningless. The daily life of the camp is an assault on body and mind. Prisoners stand for hours in snow and rain during roll call, their feet swollen, their clothes thin. They fight for crumbs, do backbreaking labor, succumb to disease that goes untreated. Guards humiliate them for sport. In such a world, it would be easy to imagine that morality is a luxury no one can afford. Yet Frankl witnesses something else. He watches one inmate slip another a piece of bread and whisper, "You take it, you need it more." He sees men share a joke in the mud, a crooked smile between them as if to say, "They cannot have this." He observes how some prisoners, weakened and afraid, nevertheless comfort others, give away energy they can scarcely spare. It is not that everyone behaves nobly. There is betrayal, cruelty, and selfishness in abundance. But the fact that goodness persists at all under such conditions becomes, for Frankl, a crucial point. If human beings can still choose generosity in a death camp, then freedom is not entirely a matter of external circumstances. At night, jammed into bunks, he lies awake and conducts mental experiments. He imagines himself in a quiet Viennese lecture hall, describing to future students the psychology of the concentration camp. He pays attention to his own reactions and those of others, not to escape reality, but to understand how people respond when pushed to the edge. He notices that prisoners who can see some future, completing a scientific work, reuniting with a loved one, warning the world, hold on more stubbornly. He sees how those who feel that nothing and no one is waiting for them often fall into apathy and die sooner. In his mind, the concept of logotherapy crystallizes further. If human beings are beings who question, then therapy must address that question. It is not enough to ask, "What do you want?" One must ask, "What is being asked of you?" There are moments when the inner freedom he speaks of seems like a cruel joke. Marching ankle deep in slush to a work site, half starved and shivering, he suddenly feels overwhelmed by misery. The camp appears as a world without exit, a universe in which the only constant is degradation. Then, without warning, his mind fills with the image of his wife's face. He does not know if she is alive or dead, but in that moment it does not matter. He walks bent under the weight of his tools and misery, yet inside, he is holding a silent conversation with her, telling her of his day, recalling their walks in Vienna, hearing her voice as if she were beside him. The guards shout, dogs bark, prisoners stumble and are beaten, but this interior dialogue continues. Later, he will write that love is stronger than the walls of a camp because it allows one to grasp another person in their very essence, even in their absence. He realizes that his wife, his love for her, is one of his meanings, one of the reasons he must endure. The external horror does not diminish, the hunger does not vanish. But a space opens in which he is not entirely at the mercy of his environment. Alongside love, he cultivates another improbable ally, humor. On some nights, he and a friend try to invent one funny anecdote each day, no matter how bleak their situation, as a way of asserting an inner distance from the camp. The joke may be trivial, but it serves as a thin thread connecting them to a life beyond the fences, a reminder that they are more than prisoners. In these small acts, an extra step to help a fellow inmate, a shared joke, a moment of contemplation before a sunset glimpsed through barbed wire, Frankl sees expressions of what he will later call the defiant power of the human spirit. The camps, designed to annihilate human dignity, inadvertently become laboratories in which that dignity reveals its stubborn resilience. Liberation does not come as a triumphal moment with waving flags and clear closure. It arrives chaotically, with rumors, confusion, and the sudden absence of guards. In 1945, after transfers between camps, Frankl finds himself among those who are finally freed. The gates open, and the surviving prisoners stumble out into a countryside unwilling or unable to absorb what they have endured. Some fall to their knees and kiss the ground. Others stare blankly, as if the world beyond the wire feels less real than the one they are leaving. For Frankl, the first sensation is a kind of emotional numbness. The longed for freedom feels strangely weightless, unreal. He walks, and the fields around him seem to stretch endlessly, yet inside he feels as if he has lost everything that anchored him. When he returns to Vienna, the city is at once familiar and alien. The cafes are quieter. Many of the shops are shuttered. The Jewish community that once hummed through certain streets has been thinned to a fraction of its former self. He goes back to his old apartment, only to find strangers living there. He learns, piece by piece, the fate of his family. His parents are gone, murdered. His brother is gone. His beloved Tilly has perished in another camp. The knowledge arrives not as a single blow, but as a series of shocks that slowly penetrate numbness. There are days when he walks along the Danube and wonders whether he can go on. The work he lost before deportation has not magically reappeared. The people for whom he would have gladly walked through fire are no longer in this world. The question that had always animated his life, what gives existence meaning, is no longer an abstract puzzle. It is the only thing standing between him and despair. In that void, he does what he has always done. He turns his experience into an object of reflection and service. Sitting at a small desk, in a modest room where the plaster is cracked and the heating unreliable, he begins to write. The book that emerges is not the academic treatise he once imagined. It is something rawer and more urgent, an account of the camps written by a psychiatrist who has lived them from the inside, followed by an outline of the theory that helped him and others survive. He keeps the tone simple, almost understated, as if grand rhetoric would betray the reality of what he is describing. He does not dwell on numbers or statistics. He focuses instead on individual faces, choices, moments when a person's stance toward fate made the difference between spiritual survival and collapse. He emphasizes, again and again, that suffering in itself is not redemptive. Only the way we respond to unavoidable suffering can be meaningful. The slim volume, eventually known in English as Man's Search for Meaning, begins as a book for a small audience. Over time, without much promotion, it spreads around the world, passed from hand to hand by people who feel that its modest pages speak directly to their own crises. Out of this narrative and his pre-war work emerges, more clearly than ever, the shape of logotherapy. Frankl calls it the third Viennese school of psychotherapy, placing it alongside Freud's focus on pleasure and Adler's focus on power. Where Freud saw the primary human drive as the pursuit of gratification, and Adler emphasized the striving for superiority, Frankl proposes a different center, the will to meaning. People, he insists, can endure pain, guilt, and even the prospect of death if they can see their lives as answering to a task, a responsibility, a purpose beyond themselves. But when that sense of meaning collapses, when life feels like an empty succession of days, or a dead-end job, or a tangle of unjust suffering, then even comfort and safety can feel unbearable. In the affluent but restless societies that emerge after the war, he detects what he calls an existential vacuum, a widespread sense of emptiness masked by busy schedules and entertainment. In his consulting room and lecture halls, Frankl sees new kinds of patients. They are not all traumatized by camps or war. Some are successful professionals who wake up one morning and realize that the ladder they have been climbing is leaning against the wrong wall. Others are young people who have more freedoms than their parents ever dreamed of, yet feel paralyzed by indecision and haunted by the thought that nothing really matters. They complain of boredom, aimlessness, a sense that life is flat. Frankl refuses to dismiss these complaints as mere neurosis. He sees in them the same underlying question that haunted the suicidal students of the 1930s and the prisoners in the camps. What is my life for? He coins the term noagenic neuroses for mental suffering whose roots lie not in biological or psychological conflicts, but in a crisis of meaning. The task of therapy, in these cases, is not to excavate childhood in search of hidden traumas or to adjust behavior mechanically. It is to help the person recognize and respond to the unique possibilities for meaning in their situation. The way he does this is characteristically concrete. In one case, he describes a physician who is consumed by grief after the death of his wife. Years of happy marriage have been followed by an emptiness that no appointment book can fill. The man tells Frankl that he cannot bear the injustice of it, that life has lost its flavor. Instead of trying to cheer him up, Frankl poses a simple question. What would have happened if he, the husband, had died first and his wife had been left alone? The man answers that this would have been terrible, that she would have suffered immensely. Frankl gently suggests that, painful as it is, the husband's survival has spared his wife that suffering. In enduring his grief, he is carrying a burden that she has been spared. The patient is silent for a moment, then quietly acknowledges that this reframing gives his pain a different color. The loss is not undone. The sorrow remains. But it is no longer sheer absurdity. It has become a sacrifice, a way of loving his wife even after her death. This is logotherapy in action, not explaining away pain, but helping a person find a meaning in it that allows them to stand upright. Frankl is careful to draw a line. He never suggests that suffering is good in itself. If pain can be removed, if injustice can be corrected, one should do so. To romanticize suffering, in his view, would be a betrayal of those who endure it without choice. But he insists that when suffering is unavoidable, when we cannot change a situation, whether it is a terminal illness, a historical catastrophe, or a personal loss, we are still challenged to change ourselves. In those moments, the question is not, why did this happen? But how shall I respond? For someone convinced that they are only the product of their environment, This can sound like an accusation. For others, it is a liberation. It means that, even in the face of injustice, one is not reduced to either passivity or revenge. One can choose, for instance, to bear witness, to use one's pain to deepen compassion, to act in ways that prevent similar suffering for others. As he travels more widely, visiting universities in Europe, America, and elsewhere, Frankl often finds himself on stages facing students who were born after the war. To them, the camps are not memories but history, grainy black and white images in documentaries. Some approach him with reverence, others with skepticism. In one lecture, a young man challenges him bluntly. How can life be meaningful when so many things are absurd, accidental, and cruel? Frankl does not respond with abstractions about providence or destiny. He tells a story from the camp, a day when a group of prisoners were marched out to work in bitter cold, and one of them suddenly pointed to the sky, to a blazing sunset that turned the clouds into a band of crimson and gold. For a few minutes, he recalls, they all stopped thinking like hunted animals and simply looked. Someone whispered, "How beautiful the world could be." The point is not that beauty cancels horror. It is that even in the middle of horror, there are moments that call us out of mere survival into something like reverence. Meaning, for Frankl, often resides in those moments of response. In the midst of his public life, he remains a practicing clinician and an intensely private man. He remarries, builds a new family, and, remarkably, resumes old hobbies. He climbs mountains in the Austrian Alps, savoring the thin air and the sense of being a small figure in a vast landscape. He takes flying lessons and earns a pilot's license, guiding a small plane over the patchwork of fields and roofs below. These pursuits are not escapism. They are, for him, expressions of a philosophy that insists life is worth engaging fully, body and soul, even after seeing its darkest side. To hike a trail, to feel the strain in one's muscles, to look down from a cockpit at the ranges that once marked borders in war. All of this is part of living in answer to the question life poses. In quieter moments, in his modest Vienna apartment, he writes, "The desk is orderly, the bookshelves lined with works on neurology, philosophy, theology, and literature." Visiting students are struck by his courtesy and his lack of self-pity. He does not dwell on his status as a survivor, though he never trivializes it. When asked whether he still feels anger at those who persecuted him, he answers not with a blanket absolution, but with a focus on responsibility. People are not simply products of systems, he insists. They make choices, and choices matter. At the same time, he argues against the temptation to reduce anyone, victim or perpetrator, to a single deed or label. Human beings are more than the worst thing they have done or suffered. Over the decades, logotherapy attracts admirers and critics. Some applaud its emphasis on individual responsibility and see in it a bracing antidote to the softer, more indulgent trends in psychotherapy. Others worry that its focus on personal meaning might overlook the structural injustices, poverty, discrimination, violence, that shape people's lives. Frankl's response is that meaning is not an excuse for injustice. It is precisely what enables people to resist dehumanization without themselves becoming inhuman. When a person finds a purpose that connects them to something larger than their own comfort, a cause, a community, a loved one, they are more likely to act in ways that change the world around them. In this sense, logotherapy is not a retreat into the self. It is a call into engagement. Seen alongside contemporaries who also reshaped psychology in the 20th century, Frankl's contribution forms part of a broader, humanistic shift in the field. Where earlier models often treated people as collections of symptoms or mechanisms to be adjusted, figures like Viktor Frankl insisted that the human person is a questioner, a meaning maker, a being capable of taking a stand toward fate. Therapy, in this view, is not merely about symptom relief. It is about helping a person become the kind of self who can say yes or no to the demands life places upon them, and mean it. In the story of Frankl's own life, That stance is visible at every turning point. In his decision to stay in Vienna with his parents, in his refusal to let the camps define the last word about humanity, in his choice to build again after loss. Today, his ideas continue to echo in places he could scarcely have imagined. A hospice nurse sits by the bed of a dying patient and, instead of speaking only of medications, asks what unfinished conversations matter most to them. A counselor meeting with an aimless teenager does not limit the conversation to grades and diagnoses, but asks, "What kind of person do you want to be for the people you love?" A middle-aged worker facing redundancy is invited to see not just what is ending, but what roles, parent, friend, citizen, remain deeply needed. In each of these encounters, Frankl's insight, that people can bear almost anything if they can find a meaning in it, works quietly in the background, reshaping questions, opening possibilities. Viktor Frankl's life, framed by catastrophe, might have led easily to cynicism or despair. Instead, it became a sustained argument, not in words alone but in choices, that human beings are more than their circumstances. He never claimed that meaning is obvious or that it can be imposed from outside like a prepackaged answer. Meaning, as he saw it, must be discovered, often in the very places where one would least expect it, in a prison barrack, a hospital ward, a moment of farewell. That discovery is not a single epiphany, but a lifelong task, renewed each time a person is confronted with suffering, guilt, or the prospect of death. In inviting others into that task, Frankl did not offer a formula. He offered, instead, a testimony that even in the darkest hours, there remains a space in which we are free to decide who we will be. In a sense, the image of that post-war lecture hall in Vienna keeps replaying. The walls are still cracked. The air is still cold. A man who has lost almost everything stands before an audience and speaks, without bitterness, about responsibility, love, and the possibility of saying yes to life in spite of everything. Some listeners leave unconvinced. Others walk out into the rubble with something they did not have before, not optimism, exactly, but a sense that their own suffering might be addressable, not by erasing it, but by answering it. The city will be rebuilt with bricks and concrete. Lives will be rebuilt with choices. In that quiet, stubborn rebuilding, Viktor Frankl's voice remains, not loud, not triumphant, but insistent that amid history's ruins, the question of meaning is not a luxury. It is the very thing that keeps us human,